Hey, Snap Nation. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for your support of Snap Storytelling from the bottom of our hearts. And if you haven't become a Snapper yet, at snapjudgment.org, you are in luck because there is still time. We made it real easy for you at snapjudgment.org. Get great stuff. Support the storytelling you love. But we decided to go even further and drop a special Snap episode in honor of the holiday to appreciate this amazing community for snapping it up. But Glenn, what holiday is that? I know. A lot of y'all celebrate 420, and the festivities can't begin without a story or two to make the season complete. So today in Snap Judgment, we proudly present High Stakes. Amazing stories about an almost inconsequential plant. My name is Glenn Washington. Pass the duchy to the left-hand side in honor of those who partake and those who do not, because you're listening.
Listen.
To Snap Judgment. We start off with one of our most requested stories of all time. It begins late in the days of the Cultural Revolution, young people everywhere experimenting with alternative ways to live fuller, more peaceful lives. But Dale just wants to do one thing. Dale wants to climb rocks, and he wants to do it in Yosemite Valley. Snap Judgment.
When I used to climb there and do hard routes, I used to walk up to the rock and smell it. The wind and the smell of the pine needles, I can't even describe it.
Dale Bard, first and foremost, was a rock climber. It was the 1970s, and the sport was still very young. Historically, mountaineers rock climbed as a way to practice for larger peaks they wanted to get up. So if you think climbing up rocks for the sake of climbing up rocks seems silly, back then, people thought it was totally absurd.
At the time, probably there was 50 rock climbers in the United States. People recognized my talents, told me I should go to Yosemite Valley. I quit college to my parents' disbelief, left with no money, and hitchhiked up to Yosemite Valley with a tent, my climbing equipment, and almost no food, an Insulite pad, and a sleeping bag. Oh, I did have a pillow. I forgot. Yes.
The valley is defined by smooth granite cliffs that reach thousands of feet up from the valley floor. At the base of these cliffs, tucked back in the forest at a place called Camp 4, Dale found his people.
And that's when I got involved in the scene.
A handful of climbers had set up a permanent camp. These climbers were some of the first climbers in the country, and they would later become legendary for their climbing achievements. But at the time, they were just some dudes in the woods that loved climbing rocks.
A day in Camp 4 was not really a day in Camp 4 because we really didn't spend much time in camp. We would go climbing all day. So train, climb, train, relax, go to sleep. My annual budget one year was negative $15.
How did you pay? Like, how did you have no money? Like, how did you...
We had connections in things. You know, we had friends in places, and sometimes I'd be given food. We did pilfer from the local grocery store every once in a while, but it wasn't a lot, but it was enough to get by.
Living like this, seeking out the free food, sometimes stealing a little on the side when necessary, these guys got this life down to a science. And for a little while, the Rangers look the other way. That is, until the riot.
In the 70s, there was a riot in Stoneman Meadow, and it's a very famous one.
Some hippie kids were camped illegally in a place called Stoneman Meadow. When the Rangers came out on horseback to break up the crowd, the kids pulled the Rangers off their horses, and chaos ensued.
When that happened, and it happened with, you know, hippies and people that smoked dope, With that, the Rangers had to change their whole style because it's the U.S. government, and they had to be able to control a situation like that. And so they created a department called LEO, which stands for Law Enforcement Officer. So in other words, they created a police force. And the camaraderie between the climbers and the Rangers diminished pretty rapidly. We called them pine pigs. How we felt at the time, this isn't your park, it's our park. All they wanted to do is drive around in cars with, you know, 45 caliber guns on their hips. We actually appreciated the park and used it the way it was supposed to be used.
After Stoneman Meadow, the climbers kept doing exactly what they'd always done. Until one morning when Dale went to the lodge for his morning cup of free coffee. And the Rangers decided it was time to teach the climbers a lesson.
We had learned some tricks. We get free cups of coffee and possibly eat off of people's plates that left their plates to be, you know, bust into garbage. I just came in one morning and kind of groggy. As I'm walking over, I look over at a table and I see this coffee cup. Put my finger through the handle and walked over to the table. And I never even made it that far. And a security guard came up to me and, you know, just said, that wasn't your coffee cup. And I'm looking at him going, okay, come on, you're kidding, right?
The officer was not kidding. They cuffed Dale on the spot and threw him in county jail for a week. He was stripped and put in a delousing tank. The bigger guys in his cell stole a sleeping pad and his pillow, and Dale slept on the concrete floor.
I had a very sobering experience, I will say that. Finally, I get shackled and put in back of a van again and driven back up to Yosemite for the trial.
The judge looks incredulous.
And he goes, you spent a week in jail for a cup of coffee? So he dismissed the charges.
But even though Dale was free from prison, the Park Service still wanted to make an example of him. So they handed down maybe the worst punishment they could think of.
They suspended me from the park for 90 days.
Why not just leave for 90 days? You know, 3 months isn't that long a time for the risk, you know, given the risk.
You don't love rock climbing, obviously. I mean, that is a long time. And it's too long of a time. If you're used to climbing every day, that's not an option. So what I did is I packed up my tent, and there's a giant boulder field behind Camp 4. And I went up into the boulder field, and I lived up in the boulder field where I was out of sight, out of mind. I still climbed every day. I just had to be very careful to not be seen. Also, you know, a lot of times I was up on a big wall. So, you know, that's a place where rangers can't find you.
Dale came out of hiding to climb and to hang out with friends at camp at night. It was on one of these nights, when Dale and some buddies were sitting around at their picnic table, that their friends Frank and Arnold rolled back into camp, visibly excited about something.
Frank and Arnold, they came in and they said, my God, you won't believe what we found.
By now, there were probably 20 or 30 climbers that lived in Camp 4. And when they heard the commotion, a crowd gathered to see what was going on. Frank told the story.
He had just taken a short tour out to this lake with a friend of his, and they were skiing back, and they looked out on the lake, and this is like early spring, so the lake is basically what is termed as candling, and meaning it's thawing out. And they saw this tail of an airplane sticking up out of the lake. The first impression was that, God, we've got to let somebody know. They also started going, man, there's probably bodies. So they started looking around, and they didn't see any bodies, but in the waters, this big thing pops up, and it's a burlap bale. And so they shimmied out there and hooked the bale with a ski pole, drug it over the ice, and got it to a safe spot, and realized what it was, opened it up, and just went, oh, marijuana. Pot.
Inside that burlap sack, they saw the treasure they had never even known to dream of. They saw their ticket to many more years of elective unemployment.
Then they looked out on the melting part of the lake and saw multiple bales. So they came back to camp and they told everybody and they said, man, there's stuff out there. And everybody had dollar signs in their eyes at that point. Hank and Stefan said, let's go. They got up the next morning, and when they came back and there was visible proof that this was real, it was a what do they call it? A run on the bank. Like everybody and his mother were grabbing whatever pack they could have and marching into the lake. Bring packs out and bust up the bales and take as much as they could as they could carry and bring it back in.
Over the course of the next few weeks, they got more and more efficient at extracting the weed, pulling it out assembly line style. They hiked out with chainsaws that they stole from the park service. One guy would cut a square of ice, the next guy would pull the ice out, the third would fish for the bales. This lake in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere, was suddenly crowded with climbers and their friends stuffing their packs with as much pot as they could possibly carry. But Dale wasn't with them. Driving the main road out to the trailhead was too risky. He might be seen in one of the cars.
And so I opted to not go to the lake.
But this didn't stop Dale from getting in on the action.
My job was to dry the pot because I could do that in the boulders.
He'd been hiding from the rangers in that boulder field for weeks, so he also knew exactly where to hide the weed.
The downside to the pot was that it had to be dried because the plane crashed, and so there was jet fuel in the water. The first couple pounds that we dried out, we didn't dry it out enough. And when you rolled yourself a joint, it was like spontaneous combustion when you put a flame to the joint. It was just called airplane weed. If you knew it was airplane weed, you knew it was tainted with jet fuel. My job was pretty simple, although I will say that every once in a while I got a little bit nauseous from the fumes because you had to rake it and stir it. And imagine 900 square feet of marijuana that you're raking and the jet fuel fumes are coming off.
Once Dale was done drying it, the pot was then transported to LA and San Francisco to be sold. It took about a month to clear the lake of all the pot they could find.
Later, we figured that a bale was probably 50 pounds dry. After all was said and done, we retrieved over 200 bales of pot. 200 bales at 50 pounds a bale. Whip out your calculator.
By the end of the run, Dale estimates they moved 10,000 pounds. Or 5 tons of marijuana.
Climbers that truly needed some financial, you know, sustenance, so to speak, they got it. I mean, some guys bought brand new cars. Some guys bought homes. I didn't make very much, but it was enough for me to live very comfortably for, you know, 4 or 5 years. By the time the Park Service found out about it, everything was gone.
When the Park Service recovered the plane once the ice melted, they didn't find much pot, but they did find 2 bodies. This story might sound kind of hard to believe, but there is actually photographic evidence. One photo is of a huge burlap sack with dark brown leaves in it. Another is of some guys chainsawing through the ice. Yet another is of some climbers wearing full backpacks, grinning from ear to ear. They look young and fit and happy.
I guess the biggest frosting on the cake, because of the LEO section of the Park Service, was touche, we got the weed, you don't even know who got the weed, you can only guess who got the weed, and we got the money and you guys got sandbagged.
There were 50, maybe even over 100 people going up to the lake that spring. So we figured it couldn't be that hard to find someone that had gone up to the lake. The people we did talk to, most of them now in their 50s and 60s, some of them with grandkids, they all fondly remember those carefree days where all they had to do was climb and dumpster dive. And of course, they all remember the lake full of pot. But when you ask them if they were there at the lake stuffing their packs full of it, a wry smile spreads across their face, and a glimmer is in their eyes. Nope, they say, definitely not me.
Big thanks to Dale for that story and for the protection of people involved. Pseudonyms were used. I also want to personally thank one of my dear friends, Cisco DeVries, whom, as we walked through Yosemite Valley a while back, he told me about this story. A story his father, Papa Tom DeVries, had worked on as a reporter many years back. Thanks as well to all the climbers that helped us, and a huge thanks to filmmakers Greg Laut and Nicholas Rosen from Cinder Films. Check out their amazing documentary on this very story, Valley Uprising. Original soundscape for that piece was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Julia DeWitt and Anna Sussman. Did you dig it? Airplane crash, mountain climbers, backpacks full of contraband. What? If you did dig it, support the show that makes it possible with whatever makes sense to you. Snapjudgment.org. Now, super snapper Josh Healy. He rocked the Mill Valley Public Library Naked Truth event. Well, we've got you a front row seat. Snap Judgment.
So this is a story about the first time I ever helped an 86-year-old with her medication. If there's anything in the world that's more awesome than a little old grandma, it's a little old grandma-in-law, which is what I have, my wife's grandma, Phyllis. Now, Grandma Phyllis, she stands about 5'1", has bleach blonde hair. She is also deeply Southern Baptist and the only one in her family who still goes to church every week. Me and her get along great. Now last year, Grandma Phyllis, unfortunately, she had this pinched nerve in her back. The doctor said she had two choices to deal with the pain. She could either get the normal prescription painkillers, or she could get a prescription for medical marijuana. Grandma Phyllis had decided that she didn't want any more painkillers, so she was gonna try what she politely called the plant medicine. Now, she wasn't driving much these days, so she needed someone to take her to the clinic. And because everyone else in the family was busy, yes, I was the one who was gonna take Grandma to get her medication. So I'd never been to a pot club before. I go to pick her up, and I take her to the club, and it didn't look like what I expected. It was actually super clean, modern. There was brown couches lining the walls and soft indie rock music over the speakers. It kind of reminded me of Starbucks. And so we go up to the counter, and the clerk's standing there, and he's this nice, tall guy. And he's got these like Buddy Holly glasses and a ZZ Top beard, and you know, he's just super cool. And he's just like, so, Can I help you two? It's me and Grandma Phyllis. And I can tell she's a little nervous, so I take the lead. And I'm like, yeah, trying to get something for my grandma-in-law? And the guy is like, sure, no problem. Can I see your prescription? So we hand it to him. He takes a look at it. And then he goes into full salesman mode. He's like, well, all right, ma'am. These are our different options. You've got purple arugula. We've got Eureka's Envy. We've got Rainbow's Revenge. But this is what I would recommend for you right here, ma'am. This is called Grateful But Not Yet Dead. This, it's what I would give my own grandma. So this is more than enough endorsement for us. So we buy the prescribed amount, and I drive Grandma Phyllis back home. I take her inside, you know, I make sure she's okay, and I'm about to put on my coat and get in my car and drive back home when, kind of out of nowhere, she pulls out a box of rolling papers, hands them to me in my direction, and says in her sweet little Southern Baptist voice, Josh, do you know how to roll a joint? I said, what? She said, well, I mean, I figured that since you were here and you know, my hands aren't too good these days, and do you think you could help me out? I'm supposed to be here for Grandma Phyllis and for her health, so I'm like, sure, why not? And I'm nervous, because, I mean, I want to make it good, but I don't want to make it too good. So I make it in a mediocre but still presentable fashion. I light it. And I pass it to Grandma Phyllis. She takes it, and she looks at it for a second. And I'm thinking she might have second thoughts. But no. She puts it to her lips, and she takes a huge hit. And then another. And then another. Then she dumps the ash in the tray, and she casually holds it between her fingers. I say, Grandma Phyllis, have you done this before? She says, no, I don't think so. But could you find me a paperclip just for the little piece at the end? Fifteen minutes later, we're sitting on the couch, sucking on butterscotch candies and watching reruns of Golden Girls. I look over to her and I say, so what do you think? How are you feeling? How's your back? And she says, you know what? I don't feel any pain right now. Seems to be working. I'm like, yes, this is great. Medical marijuana actually serving a medical purpose. Grandma Phyllis is feeling better and I'm feeling great about helping her out. So I'm just about to go put on my coat and leave again when she stops me and she says, you know, Josh, I'm probably not going to need all of this. It's too much for me. Would you like to take some home? I think about it for a second, maybe two, and smile and say, no, Grandma. My back is just fine. Thank you all very much.
Josh Healy, y'all. One love to Snap Nation. Happy 420. Legalize it. If you are not a snapper, be a snapper. Thanks for your support and your donations, if you know what I mean. It's snapjudgment.org. Peace.